This series of six lectures, titled A Theory of Productive Activity, Profit, and Saving, was delivered at the third Jefferson School Summer Conference, The Intellectual Foundations of a Free Society III, in August of 1987, on the campus of the University of California at San Diego. In following these lectures, it will be helpful to have available the lecture supplement which bears the name of the series, and which is referred to from time to time in the lectures. If you are listening to this series as part of my full program, the supplement can be found on the CD labeled Lecture Supplements. If you did not purchase the full program, the supplement should have been sent to you either on a disc or as an email attachment file. Please print out the supplement. The material in these lectures is elaborated in chapters 11, 16, and 17 of my book, Capitalism. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is George Reisman. I'm speaking to you from my office in Laguna Hills, rather than from the lecture podium at UCSD. It's been necessary to redo the first lecture of my series delivered last summer on productive activity, saving, and profit. I'm going to present this material in a conversational tone rather than attempting to make believe I'm addressing a large audience. So perhaps this will even be more effective. With that preliminary out of the way, let me make one further introductory comment. Everyone who's listening to this set of tapes should have received a lecture supplement. This supplement is extremely important to be able to follow the material. The nature of the material we'll be discussing, especially in some of the later lectures, simply cannot be grasped merely by listening. You have to be able to look at some of the examples in print in front of you. So please do not attempt to go through this material without the supplement. All right, with all of that said, let me turn to the subject that I want to speak to you about, the subject of this series of six lectures, which is the concept of productive activity, a theory of profit, and to some extent a theory of saving. Let's begin by considering the state of thought on the subject of productive activity. If you think of the ideas that people hold on the subject of what represents productive activity and what doesn't, and perhaps even some of the ideas you yourself may hold or not be able adequately to answer, I think you'll find that practically the only thing which is universally regarded as being productive is manual labor. I would say without exaggeration that perhaps half of the population does not know what half of the economic system is actually for. For example, let's consider what types of incomes are thought to be earned, to be received justly. Well, profits, dividends, interest are typically denounced as unearned income. The Internal Revenue Service, for example, makes a distinction between earned income and unearned income. The earned income is wages and salaries. The unearned income is anything that is not a wage or a salary. Labor unions share that exact same idea. In the view of the labor unions, the profits made by employers are unjust, unearned. They rightfully belong to the union membership. And the unions feel constrained only by expediency in determining how much of the profit they attempt to go after and convert into wages. Socialist governments are guided by the exact same idea. In fact, the leading goal of the achievement of socialism is to be able to take back from the alleged capitalist exploiters the profits, interest, land rent, dividends, and so forth that they are allegedly stealing from the workers. The Marxists describe socialism as the expropriation of the expropriators. So there is the idea prevalent that only wages and salaries represent earned income. All other forms of income are unearned, unjust. Now that's the leading manifestation of what I call the manual labor doctrine, the doctrine that only manual labor deserves the income it receives. There are other aspects of the manual labor doctrine which are significant and will need to be dealt with. For example, consider the prevailing attitude toward, let's say, retailing and wholesaling. A very common attitude there is that the retailers and wholesalers are, quote, middlemen, unquote, who are simply adding on their markups to the prices charged by manufacturers and farmers. Now, the implication of that is that these people are really not performing a necessary economic function. They're just raising prices to the consumers. So that's another important manifestation of the doctrine that only manual labor is productive. Still another example would be the attitudes that prevail toward the financial system, the securities markets, the banking system. All of this is typically regarded as excess baggage or a mere sophisticated gambling casino. It's not perceived as having any necessary economic function. It's not perceived as being productive. And of course, advertising is generally denounced as inherently fraudulent. Its productive contribution is not perceived. Well, a leading purpose of this series of lectures is to establish the productive role of these various activities. It's to explain what is the actual economic function of this vast area of economic activity that is typically denounced as unproductive. And in connection with this demonstration, it will be vitally necessary to develop and explain a positive theory of profit in order to show exactly what the productive function of businessmen and capitalists is. Now, let me say that in my judgment, the manual labor doctrine is a carryover from earlier centuries, from conditions in which it had a certain degree of plausibility, but it's a carryover to the modern conditions of a division of labor society in which it is totally inapplicable. Now, I want to say a few things about the division of labor. This is a subject I opened my first series of lectures at TJS in 1983 in discussing. The division of labor is a knowledge of the division of labor is really vital to understanding the nature of productive activity. What I mean by the division of labor is the fact that individuals specialize. The total labor required to support a human life is divided up into separate narrow specializations. Someone is a butcher, someone else is a baker, and a third person is a candle maker, and so forth. In contrast to the division of labor, you have the isolated, self-sufficient production of primitive farmers. If we go back and look at conditions in the days of feudalism or in early modern times, the overwhelming majority of people lived in a state of virtual self-sufficiency. That's still the way they live in much of the world, in most of the world. In those conditions, each family produced practically everything it consumed. Now, that's obviously not the case today. Today we have the division of labor carried to the greatest extent it's ever been carried to in all of history. And each of us works at producing or helping to produce just one or a very few things. Now, this change in conditions, the substitution of the division of labor for the absence of the division of labor, has profound implications for the concept of productive activity. And these implications are almost universally ignored. It's in the context of production in a non-division of labor society that the manual labor doctrine might make some kind of sense. in a non-division of labor society, if you were asking the question, how do you distinguish between productive activity and unproductive activity? What criterion would you use? Well, when you saw people physically making goods or transporting them, well, that obviously is productive activity. And that would be just about the only kind of productive activity in a non-division of labor society. The feudal aristocrats could not be characterized as productive. Their activity consisted essentially in stealing part of the output of the serfs whom they controlled. Well, people have carried over this mindset, if you want to call it that, from the days of the Middle Ages and early modern times. They've carried that over unthinkingly into their appraisal of contemporary or modern economic conditions in which we have a division of labor. And so what I will be at great pains to show is how the existence of the division of labor introduces profound changes in the concept of productive activity, how it radically changes the concept in comparison with the notion that only manual labor is productive. I'll try to show that a proper concept of productive activity, on the one side, goes far, far beyond manual labor. It includes the activities of businessmen and capitalists, the financial markets, the banking system, retailing, wholesaling, advertising. All of this vast portion of the economic system that is so continually denounced, this is, in fact, genuine productive activity, and we'll see why at length, and we'll see it in connection with the division of labor. Now, there is another respect in which the manual labor doctrine presents too broad a concept of productive activity, because it will turn out that not all manual labor is productive in the context of a division of labor society. What we'll see, in other words, is that in the context of a division of labor society, most but not all manual labor is productive, and besides manual labor, there are many other activities which are productive. Well, let me simply give you my definition of productive activity in the economic context of a division of labor society. And I ask you to keep in mind that I'm talking about the economic context of a division of labor society. I'm not passing moral judgments here on non-economic activities. So I define productive activity in this context as the making of goods and the rendering of services for the purpose of earning money. The making of goods and the rendering of services for the purpose of earning money. Now, I'm going to start with an explanation of why money making is an essential aspect of the concept of productive activity in the context of a division of labor society, and why even manual labor, which is not carried out for the purpose of earning money, is not productive. I'm going to be showing, in other words, that manual labor performed for the purpose of earning money, it represents productive activity, and all the normal business activity, the activity of businessmen and capitalists, retailers, wholesalers, etc., that is productive activity. And money making is an essential aspect of productive activity. If you are carrying on activity in a division of labor society that is not for the purpose of earning money, then from the standpoint of economics, your activity is not productive. Now, why is that? Well, the reason for that is that in a division of labor society, it is not possible for an individual to live by virtue of his own physical product. Each of us devotes his labor to producing one or helping to produce one or at most a very, very few things. And we are physically dependent for the overwhelmingly greater part of what we consume on the goods and services produced by other people. Imagine, for example, someone spends his full working time making buttons or just punching the holes in buttons.
in order for him to live, he needs an enormous variety of other goods and services. He may consume a half a dozen buttons a month, but that's about it. He cannot live by virtue of his own physical product. His physical product has to be the means of obtaining the enormous variety of goods and services produced by others that he requires in order to live. Well, how is he to obtain other people's goods and services? There's a very simple answer. He has to offer them money. If his activity is to be the means of his obtaining the goods and services produced by others, then his activity has to be carried on for the purpose of earning money. If it's not carried on for the purpose of earning money, it does not enable him to obtain the goods and services of others. He cannot live within the division of labor. He cannot support himself within a division of labor unless he earns money. Money is the means by which his productive activity brings to him the goods and services of others. That is why money making is an essential aspect of productive activity. Notice we're talking about productive activity which is geared to participating in the division of labor. We're not saying that in any imaginable context you have to earn money. If you're an isolated, self-sufficient farmer and you physically produce the whole variety of things that you consume, well then your activity does not have to be carried on for the purpose of earning money. But if all you're producing is buttons or sulfuric acid or shoes or whatever, in that context the only way your activity can bring you the goods and services you require is if it brings you money. And in a division of labor society, if your activity doesn't bring you money, it is not productive activity. Let me point out, incidentally, that this distinction explains why, despite the opinion of most economics textbooks, there is a very significant difference between the activity of a paid housekeeper and an unpaid housewife. The national income accounts are typically criticized in the economics textbooks for excluding the activities of housewives on the ground that they're not paid, yet including paid housewives. And you'll find the typical textbook will mock this procedure and say, well, what happens if someone marries his housekeeper, then national income falls? Well, let me point out that there is actually a very sound basis for treating the labor of a housewife and a paid housekeeper differently. Their physical activity may very well be identical, but there is nevertheless an essential difference. The paid housekeeper's work enables her to participate in the division of labor. Her work, for her, is the means of obtaining the goods and services of other people. The labor of an unpaid housewife, however, does not enable her to obtain the goods and services of others. The way that she obtains the goods and services of others is by virtue of money earned by her husband or earned by her in a different capacity, if she has a paying job as well as being a housewife. So there is a significant difference between physically identical activities, and the question of whether or not it's for the purpose of earning money is essential from the point of view of the activity enabling the person to participate in the division of labor. Now let me go even further with this and point out that if an activity is not for the purpose of making money, then it is not only not productive from an economic point of view in a division of labor context, but it is actually consumption. Because this activity, if it's carried on in the material world, will be using materials and equipment which the activity itself cannot replace. Keep in mind that any sorts of goods that we use, any materials, equipment, whatever, cost money to obtain. And in the course of use, we use them up, they're worn out, eventually they need replacement. Well, unless we're using them for the purpose of earning money, we're not going to be able to replace them by virtue of our own activity. So there will be consumption. Let me give you some examples. Suppose we have a housewife who makes her own dresses. Now, from a physical point of view, this activity is productive. She's physically making a product, dresses. But in order to make the dresses, she has to start with cloth, a sewing machine, and various other items. And these things cost money. The way that we obtain the starting point of production, the materials and equipment required to start any productive process, is with an outlay of money. In the course of our activity, we use up the materials and equipment. If the product that we produce is not sold for money, well, then we don't have the means of replacing the materials and equipment. Our production, from a physical point of view, ends up being a consumption. So the housewife, when she's making a dress, or making dinner, or baking a pie, or whatever, even though she's physically making something, she is nevertheless still being a consumer. She's using up materials and equipment, the replacement of which her own activity does not make possible. Now, this is in the sharpest contrast to a business which carries on the same type of activity. If we have a dress factory, well, the dress factory conceivably could use the same sewing machines as the housewife, the same cloth, etc. Everything perhaps could be physically identical. There's one crucial difference. The dress factory sells its product for money. The money that's brought in by the use of the sewing machine, etc., is the means of making possible the replacement of the sewing machine, etc. So, from the point of view of the dress factory, that process is not actually consumption. When we allow for the full process for replacement by way of exchange, the activity of the dress factory makes possible the replacement of the means of production it consumes. The activity of the housewife does not. Her activity is a consumptive production. Now, let me point out just how widespread physically productive activity is, which nevertheless is still consumption. When you go to the refrigerator and take out a couple of slices of bread and put on a slice of bologna, you are physically making something. From a physical point of view, you're producing something. But your activity is nevertheless still consumption. You're using up the bread and the bologna, and that activity does not make possible the replacement of these things. A restaurant which makes sandwiches is in a very different position. Its making of sandwiches, because they're sold, brings in the money to make possible the replacement of the materials and equipment. Now, let me point out that this discussion has some major implications for key economic concepts and their definition. Let me contrast two major types of essentially different spending, which I'll call productive expenditure and consumption expenditure. Productive expenditure and consumption expenditure. Productive expenditure is expenditure for the purpose of bringing in subsequent sales receipts. Expenditure for the purpose of bringing in subsequent sales receipts. And by implication, at a profit. You wouldn't be spending money for the purpose of bringing in the same amount of money. You want to do it to bring in more money. Well, that is productive expenditure, buying for the sake of subsequently selling. In contrast, we have consumption expenditure, which is expenditure not for the purpose of bringing in subsequent sales receipts. Consumption expenditure is expenditure for any purpose other than bringing in subsequent sales receipts. Productive expenditure is synonymous with the expenditure of business firms. Business firms, qua business firms, are spending money for the purpose of making subsequent sales. Their outlays are productive expenditure. The outlays of households represent consumption expenditure. Now, there is a radical difference in the significance of these two types of expenditure from the point of view of the individuals who make them. And that is this: productive expenditure is self-sustaining and a source of wealth. Consumption expenditure represents a using up of wealth. Productive expenditure makes possible sales revenues, which make it possible to repeat the expenditure, and generally more than just to repeat the expenditure. Normally, productive expenditure will result in a profit. That means in the earning of more money than was originally laid out. So productive expenditure makes possible the repetition of the expenditure and additional funds besides, which are available then to expand the productive expenditure or to provide for consumption expenditure. Consumption expenditure, as I say, is simply a using up of funds. When a business, let's say, buys, when a laundromat buys a washing machine, for example, its purchase of the washing machine will bring in revenues from the people who are using the washing machine, and that will make possible the replacement of the washing machine, and more than the replacement. When a housewife buys the washing machine, it could be the identical washing machine, her activity will not bring in replacement funds. Her expenditure is a consumption expenditure. Her funds are used up and gone. The laundromat's expenditure is not used up and gone. It's the source of a profit. Perhaps another example we might consider is the case of two brothers who start with an equal inheritance. Now imagine where they will be in a few years if one of them is using most of his inheritance to make productive expenditures, while the other is using his inheritance to make consumption expenditures. There'll be an enormous practical difference. The one will grow richer, the other will grow poorer, because the inherent nature of these expenditures is one is a source of wealth. It's made to bring in money and more money than it lays out. The other is a using up of wealth. You grow richer through productive expenditure, poorer through consumption expenditure. An aspect of this distinction is the distinction between capital goods and consumers' goods. Capital goods are goods purchased for the purpose of making possible subsequent sales and implicitly at a profit. Capital goods are any goods which the buyer buys for the sake of making possible subsequent sales. He doesn't have to sell the good he buys. It's still a capital good if it's used to produce something else which is sold. Machinery purchased by a manufacturing company, the company will not sell the machinery, it sells its product. The machinery is a capital good. The materials it buys are capital goods. Notice, capital goods, when viewed in the full process of what's involved, capital goods are self-sustaining and a source of additional wealth. They bring in sales revenues that make possible their own replacement and more than their own replacement. In contrast, consumers' goods do not make possible their own replacement. They are simply used up and gone. Now, there are many, many consumers' goods, possibly one could say even the majority of consumer goods, which in one way or another are used in some sort of physical process of production, but they're still consumers' goods. Think of the fact that all of the food in your refrigerator and in your pantry essentially represents materials of production. If you have canned soup, well, that's not yet ready to be eaten. You have to go through further stages of preparation. The bread and the bologna, etc., are materials. Think of all of the machinery you have in your household. We find vacuum cleaners, washing machines, dryers, dishwashers, personal automobiles, record players, phonographs. All of these things represent machinery and equipment. You have hammers and screwdrivers. Those are tools. You have knives and forks. Those are implements. All of this, nevertheless, is still consumer goods. even though they are physically the means of making something else. Now, why are they consumer goods? Well, they themselves are being physically used up, worn out. Sooner or later, they need replacement. And their own use does not bring in the funds to make possible their replacement. So they're used up and gone. They're consumer goods. The same physical items in the hands of a business firm serve to bring in the money that makes possible the replacement and more than the replacement of these items. They are capital goods. Let me point out that you could have consumers' goods which represent the heaviest forms of equipment. We can have bulldozers and tractors which are consumers' goods. We could have a bulldozer factory which is a consumer's good. When would we have such a thing? Well, if the government owns them, then they will be consumer goods. Consider, for example, the heavy construction equipment owned by the Army Corps of Engineers, which may be using it to build an air base. Well, those tractors and bulldozers and whatever, they are being used up, worn out with time. Eventually, they need to be replaced. Well, that activity, the activity of building an airbase or whatever, is not the source of any sales revenue which would make possible the replacement of these things. They're in the same position as the housewife's sewing machine or washing machine. Yet a private contractor who owns such equipment and who has paid for its use, in that case, the equipment makes possible its own replacement and more. If the government owned a bulldozer factory, the bulldozer factory would be a consumer's good, because the government's purpose in buying the factory and making the expenditures is actually not to earn a profit. It's not to bring in sales revenues at a profit. It's some other purpose, provide public service, unquote, something of that nature. And in the nature of the case, it will only be by accident that the activity will bring in more sales revenues than were required in the outlays for the equipment. Government-owned enterprises are inherently consumption activity. The post office is a consumer's good. It doesn't consume the entire outlays. It's consumed more slowly. They defray some of the costs or much of the costs through revenue. But the activity is essentially consumption in the same way your purchase of an automobile represents consumption. You may sell the car after a couple of years and you get some of your money back, but it's still a consumer purchase. Your purpose is not, you buy a car not for the purpose of selling it. You buy it for some other purpose, the purpose of traveling around. It represents consumption. You get back a scrap value or a secondhand value. Well, similarly with the post office or government enterprises, the government spends money. It may bring in some money, but that is not the overriding purpose. In the nature of the case, it will bring in less money than it's laid out. Its activity is therefore consumption. Now, we should also make a distinction between two types of labor from the perspective of the employer, namely producer's labor and consumer's labor. Both of these types of labor are paid, but producer's labor represents labor which is employed for the purpose of the employer making subsequent sales. Consumer's labor is labor which is employed not for the purpose of the employer making subsequent sales, but for any other purpose. Now, as I say, we're looking at things from the point of view of the employer. From the point of view of the employee, both types of employees are earning money. Their activity, from their perspective, is productive. But from the perspective of the employer, from the perspective of the employer who employs someone not for the purpose of earning money, the activity is consumption. A maid employed by a housewife represents consumption expenditure. The same maid employed by a hotel represents productive expenditure. The maid employed by the hotel is producer's labor. The maid employed by a housewife is consumer's labor. It's the exact same distinction as applies to capital goods and consumer's goods. The maid employed by the hotel helps the hotel to bring in paying guests, which then provides the hotel with funds which enable it to continue the payment of the maid's wages. The housewife's payment of wages does not provide the housewife with an income out of which she continues the payment of the wages. Those funds have to come from a separate outside source of revenue. Either the housewife's husband has a paying job or she has a paying job. So we have this distinction between labor and goods and expenditure. And let me point out the same distinction can be applied to loans taken out. We can distinguish two categories of loans. There are consumers' loans and producers' loans. Consumers' loans are loans which are taken out not for the purpose of earning money. Producers' loans, business loans, are loans which are taken out for the purpose of earning money. When a business borrows, there's something very different going on than when a consumer borrows. A business borrows for the purpose of using the proceeds of the loan to purchase means of production which will bring in money. A business borrows for the purpose of using the funds to make a profit, and in the normal course of events, the profit that it makes enables it to pay the interest, and the proceeds that are brought in with the means of production purchased make possible the repayment of the principal of the loan. Business loans are self-liquidating and a source of profit. Consumer loans, on the other hand, have to be paid off through an outside source of revenue or income. They are not self-liquidating. And let me point out, all business activity is self-sustaining and a source of funds over and above what's required to be self-sustaining. Consumer activity, whether it's borrowing or anything else, is not self-sustaining. It requires an outside source of funds. Within the category of consumer loans, we have to make a distinction between private consumer loans and government consumer loans. Government borrowing represents consumer borrowing, but it differs radically from private consumer borrowing. In private consumer borrowing, the borrower has to repay. When the government borrows, it is other people who have to repay, the taxpayers, who very often are the lenders. So that is a significant distinction. In this connection, let me point out that in recent, or I shouldn't say recent now, it's already more than 20 years ago, but there's a lot of nonsense uttered in connection with government deficits and the attempt to rationalize them. For example, when former President Kennedy was campaigning in 1960, he was arguing under the influence of Galbraith that no one complains when corporations, quote, run deficits. They complain only when the government runs deficits, meaning people aren't complaining when corporations borrow, they're complaining when the government borrows. And that was dismissed as the conventional wisdom, a kind of old wives' tale. Well, there's good sound reason for that. When corporations borrow, they're not running at deficits. They can be very profitable while they're borrowing. They are borrowing for the purpose of carrying on business activity, which makes possible the repayment of the loans and provides a further profit to the corporation itself. When the government borrows, its borrowing is consumption, and it's a liability on the taxpayers in the future, or will need further inflation to pay it off. Now, please don't interpret me to be opposed to consumer borrowing or to be opposed to consumption. I'm just saying that insofar as you consume, you do not grow rich. Consumption is consumption. It's a using up of wealth, not a bringing in of wealth. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't consume, that we shouldn't borrow as consumers. We certainly should. We just shouldn't be confused in thinking that that's how we create wealth as opposed to using it up. It's perfectly legitimate to borrow as a consumer. Certainly if you're borrowing something that will last as long or longer than the term of the loan, such as to buy a home or an automobile, it may not be always so wise to borrow for the pleasure of the moment and then have to pay off after the pleasure is gone, but there can be some circumstances when that's justified too. Like you want to take a vacation now, and you'll pay it off before you take your next vacation. So don't interpret me to be attacking consumption. I'm just saying we don't grow rich by virtue of consuming. That's a different process. That's production. All right, a further concept that needs a little bit of discussion, the concept of investment. I would characterize investment as a subspecies of productive expenditure. Investment represents productive expenditure for goods which continue in one's possession for some period of time after the expenditure is made. Investment, in effect, represents the putting of money into goods for the purpose of making subsequent sales. You're investing when you have a productive expenditure that buys machinery, that buys materials that are in your possession for some moment after the productive expenditure. You have investment often when you're paying wages, to workers whose labor will be materialized in products they help to produce. If you're paying the wages of manufacturing labor, that expenditure can be an investment expenditure. So investment represents productive expenditure for the acquisition of some type of asset that remains in your possession after the expenditure is passed. And very closely related to this is the concept of capital. Capital is wealth reproductively employed. Capital you could think of as being wealth which is employed in the production of wealth. Well, in the context of a division of labor society, what that actually means is it is wealth which represents outlays of money which is used to bring in money. Capital represents, in effect, the assets of business firms. In a division of labor society, capital is the wealth owned by business firms. It's the wealth which is used in the production of wealth. Now, from a superficial point of view, you could say, all right, I have wealth in my refrigerator. I'm using it to make a sandwich. That's wealth used to produce wealth. But that's really a dead-end process which results in consumption. To have wealth, in fact, result used in the production of wealth, for the reasons explained, we have to have wealth used to bring in money. Capital is the wealth owned by business firms. And the value of capital, what I refer to as capital value, is the value of the wealth of the business firms. It represents the money paid out by business firms to acquire the assets that they possess. That is the value of their capital. It's called the book value of the assets of the business firms. All right, let me take this opportunity to deal with some possible misconceptions that can arise in connection with the concepts I've presented. I've dealt with one, the notion that perhaps I'm attacking consumption. I'm not attacking consumption, I'm just saying it's not production. People often are confused about how to classify something on the following grounds. They say, well, look, suppose we didn't buy food. Then we wouldn't have the strength to go to work. We couldn't make money. So isn't consumption expenditure that's necessary to keep you alive and in health and enable you to work, isn't that in some sense productive expenditure? Now, what I would say in this case is, here we have a consumption expenditure which has productive consequences as a byproduct, as it were. But the existence of productive consequences is not sufficient to make something into productive activity. An essential aspect of productive activity is the purpose of the activity. An activity is productive activity only when its purpose is the making of money. In the context of a division of labor society. If the activity incidentally enables you to bring in money, that is not sufficient to qualify it as productive activity. Let's take a further example. We're driving our automobiles. Sooner or later, our automobiles will end up being scrapped. Now, I don't know if you're aware of it, but scrap iron is an important ingredient in the production of new steel. Well, here we have a consumption activity which has a productive byproduct, the making of new steel. But we are certainly not steel producers by virtue of driving our automobiles, even though an indirect consequence is to contribute to the future production of steel. Well, the fact that we eat and have the calories and the energy and so forth, the fact that we live and as a byproduct of living are enabled to go to work, does not mean that our activity of eating, etc., is productive activity. The purpose of that activity is not to work and earn money, it's to be able to live and stay in good health. A byproduct of being alive and in good health is being able to work and earn money. So the way I would characterize this case is I would say that the expenditure, even for the food and other items that are necessary to your life, health, and well-being, and ability to earn money, that is consumption expenditure, which has a productive byproduct. But the earning of the money is to be attributed to the labor that you're able to perform, and that labor is not a product. Your ability to get up in the morning is not a product. You do not live today to say, how am I going to produce my ability to live tomorrow? You are not living today for the purpose of living tomorrow, or let alone working tomorrow. You're living as an end in itself. Well, the fact that you can work tomorrow by virtue of consuming today does not make today's consumption a productive activity. We should attribute the income you earn tomorrow to the labor you perform tomorrow, and regard that labor as a fresh, original, unproduced factor of production. Your labor that you perform is not a product. It is the starting point of production. You do not produce your labor. Your labor is what you start with in order to produce. It's a fresh, original, unproduced factor of production. All right, let's take another issue. It's sometimes said, all right, I'm saying that a maid employed by a housewife represents consumer's labor, only a maid employed by a hotel represents producer's labor. And the objection may be raised, well, what about a housewife who employs a maid so that she can take a paying job? Or she employs a babysitter so she can take a paying job. Isn't the maid producer's labor in that case? Isn't the payment of wages a productive expenditure in that case? Again, I would say no, it isn't. But before we get to that reason, let us keep in mind first the case where the housewife is not going to work. Then it's very clear, there's no question about it. The maid is consumer's labor, her wages represent consumption expenditure. But let us now take the case where the maid is employed, so the housewife feels free to take a job, a paying job. Well, I would say the actual purpose for which the maid is employed is not to enable the housewife to make money. The actual purpose is to meet a need of the housewife's personal life. She wants to be able to have a clean house. She wants to be able to have her baby cared for, whatever it may be. She is employing the maid not to make money, but to clean her house or care for her baby. That's the purpose of employing the maid. It would be a hotel that's employing the maid for the purpose of bringing in guests, or an employment agency perhaps, but the housewife employs the person not to make money, but to meet a need of her personal life. Now that need, having to meet this need in these circumstances, is imposed on her by the fact of having a job. Earning an income can impose certain expenditures which you wouldn't have to have if you weren't earning an income. In this case, the housewife employing a maid. If you have a job, there are other expenditures which can be imposed on you, such as having to eat your lunch out rather than at home, having to travel to and from work, sometimes living in a cold climate and having a heating bill as a result. Well, I would characterize all such expenditures as work-imposed consumption expenditures. The purpose of these expenditures is not to earn money. The fact that you're making them is imposed by the circumstance of your making work, of your making money, but that's not the purpose for which you make these expenditures. You're making these expenditures for the purpose of meeting some personal need or desire in a context which is imposed by the fact that you're working. You're not making the expenditures for the purpose of bringing in an income, but for meeting a need of your personal life. So they're still consumption expenditures in my judgment. Now there's another category of question that is raised. Take the case of the housewife and the washing machine. Sometimes the point is made, well, suppose by virtue of having the washing machine, the housewife is able to save money on laundry. In the absence of having the washing machine, she has to take the clothing to a laundry or whatever, and that costs, let's imagine, $15 a week. But by virtue of buying a washing machine and spreading the cost over its life and the costs for the soap suds, etc., suppose we calculated out that doing the same amount of laundry now costs $10 a week. Well, does this shift the washing machine from the category of a consumer's good to a capital good? Can we say, well, the washing machine brings in $5 a week? I would say that's a highly illegitimate procedure. What we have in this case is the washing machine makes it possible to have a smaller consumption expenditure rather than a larger consumption expenditure. Instead of spending $15 a week for laundry, you're spending the equivalent of $10 a week, but it's still consumption expenditure. You're not bringing in money, you're reducing the consumer outlay that you make. Now, it is true that a housewife can certainly increase the buying power of her husband's income. It may be if the housewife is home, not working, she makes it possible for the same amount of money earned by her husband to go further. She can economize and do all sorts of things. That's perfectly true, but notice that the way that the housewife increases the buying power of her husband's income is to the extent that she's reducing consumption expenditures. Consumption expenditures can contribute to buying power only by virtue of being reduced. That means only by virtue of their absence. Productive expenditures contribute to buying power by virtue of their positive presence. A smaller consumption expenditure is still a consumption expenditure. Perhaps it will be helpful to drive this point home. Suppose you could have your laundry done at either of two places, laundry A or laundry B. Laundry A charges $10 for a given amount of laundry, laundry B charges $15. You switch from B to A. Are you making $5 now by virtue of doing this? I would say you're not. You're consuming $5 less. You have a consumption expenditure. It's a smaller consumption expenditure. If a washing machine reduces the cost of doing something, it's a smaller consumption expenditure. The fact that it's smaller doesn't change it from the category of consumption, from consumer's good to capital good. It's still a consumer's good. All right, another question. Suppose we have a government which spends money for the purpose of increasing the citizens' capacity to pay taxes. In other words, suppose we had a government which would devote part of its budget to river and harbor improvements, let's say, or to improving the highways so that commerce can be conducted more efficiently. And now private individuals will be able to produce more effectively as the result of the government's activity. And the consequence of this will be their capacity to pay taxes will be enlarged. Now suppose the government undertakes this construction with that very purpose in mind. Would this transform the government's outlays from consumption expenditures to productive expenditures? I would say no, they're still consumption expenditures, because even though there are productive consequences to other people of these expenditures, from the point of view of the government, the money that it spends is used up and gone. Its river and harbor improvements, highway construction, whatever, does not bring in the money to make possible the continuation or replacement of these activities, which is precisely the reason that it has to turn to taxes. If these activities were in fact productive expenditures, the government would not need taxes. Taxes are required in the for the very reason that the government's activities don't bring in the money to make possible their own continuation. And the taxes, of course, are imposed by force. Now, let me give you another analogy here. Suppose we had someone who had the habit of giving gifts of encyclopedias to intelligent children. We had a benevolent old gentleman who wanted to use some of his wealth to buy sets of encyclopedias for intelligent children. And the consequence would be that in later life, as a result of having read these encyclopedias, they'd be better educated and able to earn a higher income. What is the nature of his expenditure? His expenditure is still consumption. It has productive consequences for others, but it's still consumption from his point of view. Well, government expenditures for river and harbor improvements, etc., are consumption from the point of view of the government. Then, when the government imposes taxes as a result of the greater productive capacity, those taxes are not a sales revenue. What's making the people pay for them is the threat of going to jail if they don't. You could argue it would be a different story if we had toll roads, or if there were a way to charge for the river and harbor improvements. But if that's possible, then they can be in private hands in the first place. We don't need the government being involved. Well, when the capacity of the citizens to pay taxes is increased, that is not productive expenditure. When you consider the fact that force is involved to collect those taxes, I would say a proper analogy would be the government is in the position of let's say a long-range burglar who might be giving gifts to his future victims to fatten them up so there's more to steal later on. This would not make it productive activity. You can't go just by the fact that the government makes an expenditure which will put more money in its pocket. The money has to come in by way of voluntary exchange in order for the activity to represent a productive expenditure. And I hope this will dispose of any thought that anyone might have. Suppose we have bank robbers who are buying nitroglycerin to crack a safe, and they'll collect a lot of money as a result of doing it. That's not a productive expenditure. The nitroglycerin is not a capital good. We have to keep the context that there's more involved than just taking in a sum of money. Taking in a larger sum of money is necessary, but we all also have to keep in mind the context of a productive process. And the same thing would apply to dealing in deadly drugs. I think we'd be entitled to say that the expenditure for narcotics at wholesale is not a productive expenditure. It's not enough simply that your activity takes in money. It has to be rendering some good or service. And we have an objective definition of what goods and services are. They have to be of benefit to human life and well-being. So the fact that a drug dealer may make money is not sufficient to make his activity productive. All right, one last point, a last possible question that can arise. Is there such a thing as human capital? People can spend money to improve their personal abilities, their personal productive capacities. Now, we might call such expenditures, if they're made for vocational purposes, outlays for vocational education, you could categorize as productive expenditures. But I don't think that we can say that these expenditures in any sense represent a capital invested in oneself. An essential aspect of the concept of capital, I believe, is that it has to be alienable. You have to be able to sell it. An essential feature of capital is that you can dispose of it and live off of it even in the absence of your current ability to work and earn an income directly merely through your labor. Well, any alleged capital that you have in your person obviously cannot qualify by this criterion. But you could live off of capital that you have invested in external material goods, not any alleged capital that's in your person. So I would say that we should not call money that you've spent on behalf of improving your ability to earn an income, we should not call that part of capital. Capital is external physical assets used in the used for the purpose of earning money. There is yet one additional possible misunderstanding, even though I said the last one was the last one. I hope that I'm not being interpreted to say that housewives don't deserve to receive the money they receive from their husbands, assuming the wife doesn't work and have an income herself. Some people might object. A normal housewife fully deserves the money that she receives from her husband. He's giving her the money to run the household, and he gives her extra money for her own personal enjoyment because she's performed properly as a wife. And if she didn't, he wouldn't give her the money. And on that basis, some people conclude, well, isn't the housewife earning the money that she receives? Isn't she, after all, engaged in productive activity because she earns the money that her husband turns over to her? I would say this belief represents an equivocation. We can say the housewife deserves the money that her husband gives her, but she is not earning the money in the sense that one earns money in a market exchange. When a husband gives his wife money to buy the groceries and pay the bills, that money is not the housewife's income. Any more than when the purchasing agent of a corporation takes the money of a corporation and goes out and buys things. The purchasing agent is not selling something to the corporation. The housewife, when she receives money from her husband to go shopping or whatever, is not selling him the things she buys. And when she receives money from him for her own personal enjoyment, that money is not paid in exchange for her labor. The amount of the money that is given to her is determined by the husband's income, not by the market value of her labor. So I would say the money that that a husband typically turns over to his wife in the normal state of affairs, that is fully deserved by the wife. The housewife deserves the money that she receives from her husband. Maybe she deserves more. Possibly she deserves more. But she is not earning the money. She is not producing a good or service which is exchanged for the money. A wife is not a husband's employee, and she is not a separate business organization with which that he is dealing with. They are partners, and the husband is the partner typically, or more often than not, or at least traditionally, who earned the money. The housewife, unless she has a paying job, does not earn money. She receives money deservedly, but she does not earn it. All right, well, now let me pass, let me say before I even pass over as a means of transition, these concepts, productive expenditure and consumption expenditure, capital goods and consumers' goods, etc., producers' labor and consumers' labor, these concepts will have a very vital bearing on the subsequent development of the concept of productive activity. In particular, they're vital in understanding the determination of the rate of profit and the role of saving in the economic system. Profits are very closely connected to productive expenditure. In a loose sense, as a first approximation, we could say that profits are the difference between the sales revenues of businesses and the productive expenditures they've made. Well, it will be very necessary when we come to the subject of profits to see the role, to have a firm grasp on productive expenditure and its relationship to sales revenues. And I, in retrospect now, since this is not actually the first lecture given, it's being taped subsequent to the series, I can tell you that the concept of productive expenditure is vital to appreciating the significance of saving, but we won't actually get into saving as much as I had hoped we would have in this current series. Hopefully we will at the next TJS. Now, I'd like to mention that Adam Smith plays a very pivotal role in any discussion of the concept of productive activity. The views that I've been propounding to you on productive expenditure, producers' labor, capital goods versus consumers' goods, and so forth, I really owe to Adam Smith. In essence, Adam Smith correctly understood these basic concepts. He understood the fundamental distinction between productive expenditure and consumption expenditure, and capital goods, consumers' goods, etc. Even though he introduced a second irrelevant criterion for distinguishing between productive and unproductive activity, which was the question of whether or not the activity results in a tangible physical product. Adam Smith had two criteria for distinguishing what he called productive and unproductive labor. One was whether or not the labor was employed for the purpose of the employer bringing in subsequent sales or was not employed for that purpose. And the other was whether or not the labor resulted in the production of a tangible physical good. The issue of whether or not it results in a tangible physical good is not really essential to classifying the labor as productive or unproductive. Suppose, for example, we have, on the basis of whether or not the labor resulted in a tangible physical good, Adam Smith argued that people like actors, musicians, and so forth were not productive labor. He categorized them as unproductive labor because they didn't produce a tangible physical product. Their product vanished in the instant it was created. Well, that is a very different criterion and one which contradicts the criterion of whether or not the labor is employed for the purpose of earning money. If we have a theater company which employs actors, The expenditure of the theater company is productive expenditure. The payment of the wages of the actors is a source of revenue to the theater. The fact that the service disappears in the instant it's performed is irrelevant. By the same token, we could have workers who are producing a tangible physical product and they're still consumers' labor. For example, we might have welders that work in a shipyard owned by the Navy, and they're producing a very tangible physical product, a ship. But that whole activity is still consumption. So Smith was confused on these questions, but he did properly identify the essential characteristic of productive activity and productive expenditure, which is that it's for the purpose of making money. Now, let me quote you a couple of passages from The Wealth of Nations to bring out where Smith has the sound ideas and also the extraneous element he introduces. He says, quote, "There is one sort of labor which adds to the value of the subject upon which it is bestowed. There is another which has no such effect. The former, as it produces a value, may be called productive, the latter, unproductive labor. Thus, the labor of a manufacturer adds, generally, to the value of the materials which he works upon, that of his own maintenance and that of his master's profit. The labor of a menial servant, on the contrary, adds to the value of nothing. Though the manufacturer has his wages advanced to him by his master, he in reality costs him no expense, the value of those wages being generally restored, together with a profit, in the improved value of the subject upon which his labor is bestowed. But the maintenance of a menial servant never is restored. A man grows rich by employing a multitude of manufacturers, he grows poor by employing a multitude of menial servants." Well, notice Adam Smith has the correct idea here mixed with an incorrect, non-essential idea. The owner of a theater company, the owner of a restaurant, employs, quote, menial servants whose labor is not vested in a tangible physical product, but he can well grow rich. You could employ labor whose labor is vested in a tangible material product and grow poor if you're employing workers to build you a luxurious mansion, let's say, or the naval shipyard example. Now, what is also very important is Adam Smith saw the implications of these concepts for the role of government, for appraising the productive role of government. He says, quote, "The labor of some of the most respectable orders in the society is, like that of menial servants, unproductive of any value, and does not fix or realize itself in any permanent subject or vendable commodity, which endures after that labor is passed, and for which an equal quantity of labor could afterwards be procured. The sovereign, for example, with all the officers both of justice and war who serve under him, the whole army and navy are unproductive laborers. They are the servants of the public and are maintained by a part of the annual produce of the industry of other people. Their service, how honorable, how useful, or how necessary soever, produces nothing for which an equal quantity of service can afterwards be procured. The protection, security, and defense of the Commonwealth, the effect of their labor this year, will not purchase its protection, security, and defense for the year to come." Well, now again, Adam Smith's essential thought is absolutely correct. It's brilliant. He recognizes that the expenditure for the government employees, the whole government budget, does not bring in revenue to the government. The fact that it's not for producing tangible products is irrelevant. In fact, the government does often produce a physical product, river and harbor improvements, etc. It's still unproductive. It doesn't bring in the money. It still represents consumption. What Smith did see is that what the government spends this year, which protects the country this year, does not make possible the repetition of that protection the next year. It's consumption. So he was essentially correct on that. Now, Smith occupies a very pivotal position in the history of economic thought. He represents, in some respects, the best, and in other respects, the worst of economic thought. Insofar as he sees the essential nature of consumption versus productive expenditure, the essential nature of capital, he represents the best of economic thought. But there are other respects in which he represents the absolute worst of economic thought, because he set the stage for Karl Marx. He provided the foundation for the Marxian exploitation theory. And we can see a hint of that in one of the passages that I've quoted. He says, and I'll repeat this particular sentence, he says, "Thus the labor of the manufacturer, the worker who's producing the tangible good, adds generally to the value of the materials which he works upon, that of his own maintenance and of his master's profit," unquote. Now, a correct phrasing of that point of view, of that of those facts, would be to say, workers who are employed for the purpose of bringing in subsequent sales help the employer to bring in the sales. They do not bring in the sales for him. But that's what Smith is implying, that the workers are by themselves producing the product and earning the profit of the employer. Now, that idea is brought out a lot more sharply, in much stronger language, in some other passages in The Wealth of Nations, which I want to quote to you, which very clearly imply that profits and any income other than wages are an unearned, unjust income, and which is the starting point for Karl Marx. So let me quote to you some passages from The Wealth of Nations in the chapter on wages. Smith says, quote, "The produce of labor constitutes the natural recompense or wages of labor." In other words, the worker's physical product, in some sense, he's calling the worker's natural wages. Then he says, "In that original state of things, which precedes both the appropriation of land and the accumulation of stock, the whole produce of labor belongs to the laborer. He has neither landlord nor master to share with him. Had this state continued, the wages of labor would have augmented with all those improvements in its productive powers to which the division of labor gives occasion." And then he continues a little bit further on, quote, "But this original state of things, in which the laborer enjoyed the whole produce of his own labor, could not last beyond the first introduction of the appropriation of land and the accumulation of stock." Stock is what Smith meant by stock was Smith's word for capital. "It was at an end, therefore, long before the most considerable improvements were made in the productive powers of labor, and it would be to no purpose to trace further what might have been its effects upon the recompense or wages of labor," namely the workers enjoying the whole produce of their own labor. "As soon as land becomes private property, the landlord demands a share of almost all the produce which the laborer can either raise or collect from it. His rent makes the first deduction from the produce of the labor which is employed upon the land. It seldom happens that the person who tills the ground has the wherewithal to maintain himself till he reaps the harvest. His maintenance is generally advanced to him from the stock of a master, the farmer who employs him, and who would have no interest to employ him unless he was to share in the produce of his labor, or unless his stock was to be replaced to him with a profit." Now catch this, please. "This profit makes a second deduction from the produce of labor which is employed upon land. The produce of almost all other labor is liable to the like deduction of profit. In all arts and manufactures, the greater part of the workmen stand in need of a master to advance them the materials of their work, and their wages and maintenance till it be completed. He shares in the produce of their labor, or in the value which it adds to the materials on which it is bestowed, and in this share consists his profit." All right, well, please notice the central ideas that are propounded in the passages I've just quoted to you. Smith claims, and this much is correct, that labor is the source of all wealth, labor in one form or another. But he claims that the income of all labor is wages. He's assuming that the income of labor is automatically wages. And he's saying the wage earners, as the only type of labor, have the right to the full produce or the full value of the produce. Now he's claiming that originally in a state of nature, which he's implying is a standard by which we should gauge contemporary civilization, and it was fashionable at the in the late 18th century to resort to a state of nature and use it as a standard by which to judge present-day civilization. That's what Rousseau did, and that's what Smith is doing here. He's claiming that originally all income is wages, and by implication that all income is rightfully wages. All income is naturally wages, and therefore rightfully wages. And he's arguing that profits, land rent, and naturally interest, although he doesn't mention interest, but that's certainly implied, all income other than wages he views as a deduction from what is naturally and rightfully wages. And by implication, it's an unjust deduction. The wage earners, they're the labor. Wage earners are synonymous with labor. They produce the product. Yet a portion of the income that they produce is being deducted in non-wage incomes, principally profit. And how does this come about? What makes possible the deduction of profits from wages? What disturbs this natural state of affairs that might have been developed further? Well, it's the appropriation of land as private property. When private property comes into existence, the landlord demands a share of what the wage earners produce as rent. And elsewhere in The Wealth of Nations, Smith has a passage which says, landlords, like almost all other men, love to reap where they have never sowed, and so demand a share of the wage earners' produce. And when do profits come into existence as a deduction from wages? Well, when capital comes into existence. When capital and capitalists emerge, then profits come into existence and are a deduction from wages. Well, Smith advances what I call the primacy of wages doctrine. Wages he considers to be the original primary form of income, and all other incomes are an unjust deduction from wages. Now, that same essential idea shows up a couple of generations later in Karl Marx. I should say about three to four generations later in Karl Marx. And Karl Marx starts off with what in essence is Adam Smith's early and rude state of society, but he has a somewhat different terminology. He imagines a state of affairs in which there are manual laborers producing and selling products. There are no capitalists of any kind. The manual laborers produce and sell the products. They keep the whole sales proceeds. They do not in any way act as capitalists. There is no productive expenditure present. There's no buying for the sake of subsequently selling. Each seller turns around and consumes his products. We have no capitalists, no capital, no productive expenditure. We just have manual laborers producing and selling products. They keep the whole proceeds. And Marx calls this state of affairs simple circulation. Simple circulation. And he characterizes it with a sequence of letters CMC. And what that means is the workers are producing and selling commodities, C, for which they receive money, M, and they turn around and they buy other commodities, C. This is the equivalent of Smith's early and rude state of affairs. All income in this state of affairs is supposed to be wages. There are no profits, interest, and land rent. In Marx's terminology, there's no surplus value here. There's no exploitation. Everything is just fine. When does exploitation begin? When does surplus value, the emergence of income other than wages, come into being and serve as a deduction from what allegedly is all wages? Well, that comes into existence, according to Marx, with the development of capitalism and capitalists. It comes into existence with capitalistic circulation. Capitalistic circulation represents the existence of productive expenditure. And capitalistic circulation, Marx characterizes with the sequence MCM prime. In capitalistic circulation, a productive process begins with an outlay of money, M, which results in the production of a commodity, C, which is sold for a larger sum of money, M prime. Now here, in this context, capitalistic circulation, says Marx, exploitation begins. Incomes other than wages are deducted from what naturally and rightfully belongs to the wage earners. It's exactly the same thing as Adam Smith's early and rude state of society. I hope you'll be able to keep in mind what role that productive expenditure and our understanding of it is going to play quite a role in challenging this whole view of things being propounded by Smith and Marx. But before we get into that, I am going to give you an exposition of the content of Marx's exploitation theory. Marx goes beyond Adam Smith. Adam Smith set the framework of the exploitation theory, the notion that originally all income is naturally and rightfully wages, the other incomes are then a deduction. Marx takes over that framework, and then he wants to go on and explain what it is that determines how much of the incomes allegedly deserved all by the wage earners is exploited from the wage earners. What determines the extent of surplus value, the non-wage incomes? And the body of doctrine that Marx offers as the explanation is the exploitation theory. And in presenting the exploitation theory, he borrows further ideas from Adam Smith and to some extent from Ricardo, namely, it's the labor theory of value. But we'll get into that in lecture two. His main indebtedness to the classical economists is to Adam Smith, in my judgment, for the framework of the exploitation theory. And in lecture two, we'll trace the development of the body of Marx's exploitation theory. But that will have to wait until tomorrow. After going through, or I shouldn't say tomorrow, until lecture two, after going through a development of Marx's exploitation theory, we'll examine the critique that has been made of Marx by Bohm-Bawerk, who's the leading critic of Marx, a leading representative of the Austrian school. Bohm-Bawerk wrote in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And that will be presented in lecture three. In lecture four, I will start to present my own positive theory of profit and begin to apply it to a critique of the whole framework of the exploitation theory. And then we will go on from there. We'll look at the various other productive functions. We'll look at what the positive productive functions of businessmen and capitalists are, the productive functions of retailing and wholesaling, advertising, etc. And to some degree, we'll get into saving and have a look at some of the epistemological implications of the theory that we'll be applying. So that ends this replacement discussion of lecture one. I thank you very much.